A podcast of the cinema.
Yeah, you do sound louder than me.
Yeah, I don't know what that's about.
Maybe take your big mouth away from the microphone.
I've been doing that. You're Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duralde. We are film critics.
For a variety of locations.
Sure.
You are the film reviews editor of The Wrap.
Yes.
Also, you are one quarter of the talent pool at What the Flick.
Also, yes.
And I, look what I just did. I made this.
You have
saffron water.
Oh, that's what that is. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Before we get into that, you are Dave White, and I'm Alonzo Duralde, and we are espoused, and
yes.
This is our show. And welcome, if you've never listened before.
Happy Mother's Day.
Yes.
To all you mothers.
Mm-hmm.
All you
funky mothers,
to all you mothers, and all you children.
Thank you, Celine,
and all the parents. This show is dedicated to all
the
parents,
parents of the world
and all of the children
of the world.
Literally
everyone.
Yeah. I made saffron water.
Okay, explain this because it looks like I thought it was just tea. Like it looks like
this is the tea.
Right.
That I'm holding in my mug.
Yes.
Of tea.
You've got this.
That I just put down on the table.
You've got this. You've got this glass of water that is, you know, saffron colored, but I thought it was some sort of like hibiscus something. I don't know what.
It is a component of a recipe
mm-hmm.
that I will be serving you and some friends
mm-hmm.
tonight at dinner.
Does this, are you pouring it into something or
drizzling it onto the finished product?
Oh.
But I have to make it now.
Gotcha.
Because it's like boiling water
and like
mixed with yesterday.
A hair of saffron?
No, a good chunk of it.
Really?
And I put it in the bowl and made a makeshift mortar and pestle
mm-hmm.
with a ceramic bowl and a spoon, and I just ground it up.
Okay.
And then there's like a little salt grains in it to help really mm-hmm. get it ground up.
Yeah.
And now, whatever threads didn't get ground up, they'll sink to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can skim off the top the rest of what I need for the recipe.
Gotcha.
In the recipe, okay, so my friend Margie gave me this cookbook. Okay, she didn't give it to me.
It's a loan. She's made it clear.
She's made it clear.
She wants it back.
ASAP. It's called Taste of Persia.
Hmm.
By a woman named Naomi Duguid, D-U-G-U-I-D. A cook's travels through Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, and Kurdistan.
All right.
And everything in it looks delicious. Even the recipes that call for tongue.
Okay.
Which I might do someday eventually, right, if I feel like it. Sorry, vegans. Everything that I am making for dinner tonight comes from this cookbook.
Okay.
So I made the halva
mm-hmm.
for dessert. It's dates and walnuts in a paste.
Right.
I got up this morning and made that.
Which you described as the puck you made for dessert.
Yeah, I made a dessert puck. The saffron water is going to go on something called spinach borani, which is like spinach and yogurt and some other things. And it sounds really good. And then the big deal dish is this baked chicken in rice.
Okay.
That is, again, marinated in a yogurt itself for like 24 hours.
Well, if you want more talk like this, you should subscribe to our food podcast, Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is available to our Patreon subscribers at patreon.com/linoleumknife. But hey, Dave, this is our movie podcast.
You know what's so weird? I wasn't even thinking about that. I wasn't even thinking about Patreon.
This wasn't a tease. It's just what we talk about.
I wasn't thinking about Patreon, but yeah, I mean, we are perhaps the only married film critics in the world currently, gay or straight.
Yep.
Also, I think we might be the only film critics with a food podcast.
Could be. Yes, we're branching out a new territory.
We just like it so much.
We're completely underqualified to have, but that's not. We're not letting that stop us at all.
I don't think we're underqualified because we like to eat so much.
That is true.
And I cook a lot.
We're autodidacts.
And I'm always talking about cooking with people. Mm-hmm. I talked about cooking this morning, baking with the Apple Genius Bar guy.
That's right.
He's my new boyfriend.
Well,
First of all, he helped fix my laptop, although it's still not completely done because Gary Gotti's going to come over here today and help me reinstall my, or
put things back on your hard drive.
He's going to pour the hard drive ingredients back into the computer with the little box.
Yes. This is why you need a boyfriend who works at the Genius Bar.
But this morning, my Apple Bar Genius boyfriend fixed the clankety bunk that was misfiring, and the belt was broken on the electrocardio schnook. These are ingredients in the computer.
And so naturally, you talked about macaron.
Well, here's what I learned from this adorable teddy bear of a man.
Who is married to a woman.
A, that he bakes his own macaron.
Mm.
And I said, no, you don't. And he goes, I do. I go, you just started baking and you're making your own macaron? And he goes, yeah. He goes, you can do it too. And I was like, no, I can't. I said, La Durée is four doors down at this mall. Why don't we just go there for the macaron? That's what I'm going to do when I'm done here. And then we stood there while he fixed the computer and did something with an operating system. I don't know what an operating system is. And we talked about baking the entire time. And his wife is not allowed in the kitchen while he's baking because she ruins things. She tries to help and she ruins things.
I will quite happily give you all the space you need if you're going to make macaron.
You already do that. I'm never making macaron. We've got a lot of room. They're too hard. He even said, he goes, look, they are hard. They're hard to do. They're finicky, and they will fail on you.
That was why my mother never understood the whole thing of people like making frozen pizza or like those kits. You know, remember those crappy Chef Boyardee kits where you would make your own pizza?
Yeah, yeah.
She's like, they make it for you and they bring it to your house.
Yes.
How much easier can that be?
I don't
be?
Ever have to make my own pizza because someone's going to bring me one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say, in my early adulthood, I did go through a severe Boboli period.
Everybody did. It was the 90s.
Mm.
Boboli was new.
Yes.
And it was exciting looking because we thought we were getting a healthier pizza.
It's a big wad of bread.
Yeah, we were not getting
it. It was delicious, pizza. But you know.
And so anyway, this dude at the Genius Bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's my new boyfriend.
That's great.
And you can, you know.
If he'll fix my laptop also, then I endorse this.
You can make room in your heart for more love. We're polyamorous now with the heterosexual.
The straight guy from the Genius Bar.
The straight guy from the Genius Bar.
Who makes
Bar.
Macaron. Okay.
But currently I'm operating on a notebook situation. I don't have my laptop in front of me, which means you're going to read the questions.
I'm reading the mail today,
from
yes.
people today. And I don't have all my notes that used to be in the laptop. I now had to invent on the paper.
You'll be fine.
While I look lovingly at this saffron water.
Oh, hey, here's an exciting bit of news to share.
What is it?
I am guesting this week on one of your favorite podcasts.
Oh, yes, you are. When are you recording this?
Monday night, tomorrow night.
You're going to be on Pop Rocket.
I am.
With Mr. Guy Branum.
Yes. And Margaret Wappler and all the folks.
I'm Karen Tongson, so stoked.
Winter Mitchell.
I got to say, I'm a bit envious of you because it's you and not me.
They should have you on. You should totally do
They don't know me. You're the listen, I know my place on the totem pole of film criticism. You're the dude, and I'm your, in the words of that publicist back when we saw Bad Santa 2, is this just a guest? To which I replied, yes.
You are not just a guest. You know that. I have.
Oh, am I?
Do I? Please. I have the venue, but you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I know. They invited you. And I'm honest. Let me be 100% genuine here. I'm so excited. I'm so excited that you're going to go on. I mean, I don't even care. Honestly, I don't give a damn if I'm on Pop Rocket or not. It'd be fun.
You should go on.
Because I have jams.
You have jams.
I have jams, and they always want to know your jam. And yes. I listen religiously to Pop Rocket. I adore it. And so, yeah, maybe... maybe someday I'll get to be a guest someday when I'm fancy like you.
Well, it's good to have goals.
You're very fancy. You do not underestimate your fanciness, right?
Okay, fine, I'm fancy.
You have a thing coming up that's going to prove to everybody on the planet how fancy you are.
Yes, unless it goes down in flames.
I'm teasing your thing again.
I know.
I've been holding it out as a mystery to all kinds
this
of people.
All
lately.
Sounds obscene when you say it that way, but yes, you are. It's a thing that's happening in the future, yeah. And we'll tell you about it when we can tell you about it.
When it's time.
Yes.
I mean, we can say it kind of what it is. You're going on TV,
ish.
But we don't. We're not going to tell you yet what it is. It's actually more exciting than you being on Pop Rocket.
Sure, yes.
Come on.
But they're both... I'm excited about both of them.
Well, yeah, of course you are. But come on, you know which one's more exciting.
It's not a contest.
Everything is a contest. This marriage is a contest. Who's winning today in this marriage? I'm thinking it's me, because I'm making all these foods from the Persian cookbook.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of that line.
We're stalling because we don't want to talk about the puke movies that opened this weekend.
I'm reminded of that line from Company where somebody says, "You always look like you're keeping score. Who's winning, Bobby?"
Me.
Fine.
Me.
Who's not winning is Guy Ritchie.
Hey, okay. Say, you talk about this. Talk about King Arthur. Because I... Listen, I know you're right. I know you're right. Everything you're about to say about King Arthur, I know you're right.
It's true, but. Is that what you're doing?
It's true, but.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. And whenever there's a subtitle, you know they think there's going to be multiple chapters of this thing.
And whenever there's a sword in this movie, you know there's a dick.
Oh my God. So many phalluses. It's like, can King Arthur's sword beat Jude Law's very, very tall tower? Like that.
It's more than the tall tower.
Let's ask the snakes.
It's,
you know?
It's that whole. It's that whole thing with the the tower erupting and the big
orbs
at the bottom and the and the ladies all marveling at the tower erupting. Ooh. It's. Out of control.
Yeah, yeah.
How much... Well, okay, I'm going to shut up. Say your thing.
Yeah. So Legend of the Sword, they clearly intend this to be a chapter one. It is totally... We're in origin story territory here. But hey, it turns out this movie cost like $175 million and it made like 14 in the United States this weekend.
I feel sorry for it.
We are not going to see a sequel, so too bad. So yeah, it kind of mucks about with the Arthurian legend somewhat, like Mordred is now somebody in the past as opposed to in the future and whatever, but basically, we begin with Uther Pendragon, played by
Eric
Bana, and then Jude Law is his evil brother, Venereal, I don't remember what his name is.
Venereal.
So, of course, Venereal is bad news, and he has studied with the evil mages, and so he stabs...
But in the past, the mages lived in peace with the humans.
Yes.
And the mages are supernatural entities that blah, blah,
the
blah.
Wizard, blah, blah. And so, they've been driven out, and Merlin is dead, and there's giant elephants, and... Anyway, amidst the loud, jumbled chaos, and there's a lot of loud, jumbled chaos in this movie, venereal kills.
His name is like Vortigern or
something. Yeah. Jude Law. Jude Law.
But venereal.
Jude Law kills Uther Pendragon and his wife in front of Lil Baby Arthur, who gets put in a raft and sent down the Thames.
Like Moses.
So like Moses.
He's just a little tiny baby.
Yeah. And he is collected by some Huas and raised by Huas in a house of Huas.
But then he learns martial arts from a man they named
Kung Fu George.
Kung Fu George.
The one Asian in all of ye old Londinium.
Oh my.
And okay, there's...
Let's return to our discussion of Ghost on the Shell for just a moment. This is the category of racism that I refer to as tokenism. But it's an added little bit of weirdness because he only has a name that is Kung Fu George, which too much.
Is there an Asian equivalent to the magical Negro in this narrative, like in as a trope? Has anybody named yet?
Well, I don't know if they've named it. I don't know if they've named it like they named the term magical Negro, but. This guy isn't even a magical Kung Fu George because he's in the movie for like 6 seconds.
He pops up here and there, but yeah, he doesn't get much to do.
Cumulative 6 seconds.
Basically, it's like ever since Batman Begins, you have to have a Kung Fu George now. Right. Like, you can't just learn street fighting. You also have to learn the ways of the Mystic East.
And Krav Maga at the same time.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, so... And I will say, of the things in this movie that I didn't hate, I kind of dug the insanely fast-paced... Arthur grows from toddler to Charlie Hunnam montage.
That was exciting to look
at. Yeah, it's this crazy rapid-fire succession of him getting slapped, him hiding money, him slapping back, him learning things. Da, da, da.
I wish the entire film had been that.
Kinda.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. Anyway.
It would have been like the Run Lola Run of King Arthur movies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, so King Arthur, or young Arthur, does eventually grow up into being Charlie Hunnam, who... people were goofing on me for talking about his A-Crew casual separates, but I'm serious. The movie really dwells on the fact that he's like the one person in the film who dresses in a neutral tone.
Say the Monty Python thing.
Yeah, you can tell he's a king because he hasn't got ish all over him, you know. You're testing the clean podcast here. Anyway, blah, blah. He pulls a sword out of the stone and the old Uther's old... You know, seconds in command are all excited because he's going to lead the revolution. But it's a Joseph Campbell. I don't want to. I don't want to. I don't want this. Order. I don't want to be king. I don't want. I don't want. I don't want. I don't want. I don't want to. He rejects his quest a lot and then finally accepts his quest.
And he does it while looking, while being very good looking.
Very good looking.
Yeah.
And if you were a fan of Queer as Folk, Charlie Hunnam and Aidan Gillen.
The OG Queer as Folk of England from the olden times in the 90s.
The UK Londinium version. Or where do they live? Manchester?
Manchester.
Manchesterium. Yeah. So they're both in this thing. And then like giant CG snakes and a mage whose eyes turn into like cat things. And big tall tower. Tall tower for the strength of the mage and the because so much tower.
Right.
Yeah. And it just this was a headache after a while.
Okay, let's set aside Kung Fu George, which is a big racist rock in the shoe.
Yes. There's more rock than shoe here, I think, but go on.
I have been a fan for a very long time. Of Guy Ritchie's WrestleMania with masculinity.
And class.
And class. Because Mr. Ritchie is himself posh AF. Yeah. Okay? The guy is a baronet. I don't even know what a baronet is or what they do in the aristocracy of England. I just know that he is one.
What I almost wrote in my review, but I thought it was going to be too UK slangy, was that, of course, you know, Ritchie would relate to a character like Arthur, who is toff by nature and yob by nurture.
Right.
Because, Mr. Ritchie is a fancy Dan, but he fancies himself a hard man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or at least he fetishizes them.
He fetishizes them in a gloriously homoerotic way.
Yes.
And has for, like, the beginning of his, since the beginning of his career.
Yeah, going into, like, rock and roll, where it crosses the line into actual homoeroticism.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Tom Hardy. He knows he's doing it. It's not unconscious. It's not unconscious. It's a thing that he knows he's doing. Because he does it every single film. It's class warfare, and he's being pulled into on this subject. And it's men touching men, loyal to men, fighting with men. Men.
As I think Dennis Quaid once described after doing The Long Riders, you know, he said, Walter Hill, manly men doing manly things with men.
Yeah. That's Guy Ritchie's
aesthetic.
Reason for existing.
Yeah.
And so this film is exactly like the other films. It's not as good. It moves really, really well. It looks really cool. All the people.
It looks like Sherlock Holmes in that it's like the sky is CG and the ground is CG,
right,
and the everything is CG.
Yeah. And everyone in the film substitutes the F sound for the TH sound.
Something?
Arthur. King Arthur.
King Arthur.
I can't even do it. But I said on Twitter, and Gary Cotti said the same thing, they all sound like Adele accepting a Grammy.
Thank you. My muffa.
Yeah. So there is entertainment to be found here.
It feels longer than it is,
but it's pretty dumb. And like,
there was the first third or so, I was being very forgiving about how dumb it was because it was at least sort of zipping by and being breezy.
Yeah,
but then it was like wading through muck, you know. I remember before, it was like, oh god, I think it's less than 2 hours. Like, that's the thing now when you see franchising movies, oh, it's under 2 hours. Whew, right. You know, we've dodged that bullet, but boy, it felt like four.
I just wish at some point in the film Kung Fu George had said to everyone, would you wankers stop calling me Kung Fu George? You racist jerks. My name is, you know, something in Mandarin that,
right.
that no one can pronounce, but that everyone is forced to pronounce properly or risk the wrath of George.
Whose name isn't even George.
That's what I was hoping for.
I remember really digging Charlie Hunnam on Queer as Folk. And then I never watched Sons of Anarchy. But I've now seen him back-to-back in Lost City of Zed and this.
Dude is a movie star. That camera likes him.
He is movie star face, but neither performance is grabbing me.
I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
If I had seen this before Lost City of Zed,
yeah,
I would say maybe they don't know what to do with you yet. Maybe they just are in love with your face. And why wouldn't they be?
It's a great face.
It's a good face. And you and I differ on Lost City of Zed. I think his performance is really lovely and moving, actually, in Lost City of Zed. And I'm now on board with him as a person in movies.
Okay.
Yeah. Did you
see Nicholas Nickleby back in the day?
Nope.
Me neither.
Pop filter.
That was his one sort of like movie carrying attempt before like going back to TV for a while.
Right.
I find him kind of one note in both of these. So I still have faith that they'll figure out what to do with an adult Charlie Hunnam on the movie screen, but I'm not seeing it yet. Although, obviously, he was smart enough to get out of doing 50 Shades of Grey, so there's that.
What was that about?
He was the original Christian Grey.
Oh, they cast him.
Yeah, and then he like,
said, oh, wait.
Broke his ankle or something.
And well, was you like, know what? He smelled a turd.
Yeah.
And he was smart. Thankfully, the two leads that we have in the 50 Shades movies,
yeah,
they have also smelled the turd.
While simultaneously perpetrating the turd.
But here's the thing. The movie...
It's not their fault.
The series is so much bigger than them.
Yeah.
And they are both such appealing screen people
mm-hmm.
that you look at them in these films and you think, you'll be fine. This isn't going to harm you in the long run. It's ridiculous, it's not going to hurt you.
They are in a train car that smells like farts.
Yeah, yeah.
But that will still get them to the station.
Yes. And the station is better films.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anything else about King Arthur worth noting?
No. Talk about Obit. I was going to watch it on the screening link.
But then you didn't have
you
a computer.
Gave me, but then my computer died and had to go sit in Apple repair garage all week.
Yes.
For the clinkety clankety bonk to get fixed. And so I have not seen Obit, but I want you to talk about it because... I'm going to watch it because okay. It looks really fascinating.
Yeah, it's quite lovely. It is a documentary about the New York Times obituary section. And it is, it's about a lot of things. It's sort of about how the way that we cover death in the media has changed. Like they quote these sort of late 19th century, early 20th century newspaper accounts that are sort of like, as the sun disappeared in the twilight sky, so did Bertha McGurk's soul leave this earthly raiment to blah, 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 blah.
Really?
You know, yeah. And they don't do that anymore. And, you know...
I want somebody to say that about me.
And while they, you know...
I want them to call me Bertha McGurk.
Absolutely. while there's a definite format involved in, like, you know, age, location, you know... of what, according to whom, survived by, that kind of thing.
Yes.
The New York Times has allowed itself to get a lot freer about how these obits are written.
Yeah.
So, like, sometimes you'll have an obit of somebody where the name doesn't even come up until, like, the second or third paragraph. They'll sort of set the stage of the cultural or political or scientific, whatever, context of this person and what they accomplished. And so... the people who write these obits are fascinating, and they talk about their job as like, oh yeah, people think this is, you know, morbid or depressing, or they think of the obit section as where they used to send you at a newspaper if they were punishing you or if you were on the verge of dying yourself.
Really?
Yeah, but now it's actually like a place where you get to do kind of like both creative writing and obviously under the gun deadline writing because... there's no planning for this stuff. I mean, you know, yeah, you have stuff on file for a lot of people.
You've got files being kept on, like, super... like, Olivia de Havilland's file is really
it's bulging.
Thick right now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of pre-set ones, but they're still, you know, forgetting...
Kirk Douglas.
Yes.
They're going to... all they have to do with Kirk Douglas
press
is...
press a button.
Is press a button. It's already written.
They already have mournful quotes from his loved ones. No, but, you know, and it's interesting from the point of view of how do you encapsulate someone's life? How do you celebrate their accomplishments? How do you situate a person in a time and place that explains why, what their significance was? But then it's also just about kind of the process of journalism because, and they talk about how, you know, if you cover City Hall or you cover, you know, Symphony Hall, you have a Rolodex of names that you go to and you ask your questions.
Yes.
But for every one of these, it's, you're starting fresh. You know, you have to track down the survivors and the coworkers and the, you know, whatevers. So it's this movie that kind of celebrates writing and journalism, which is lovely because this is an era in which they are... you know, I would say in the last few months, suddenly we've all gained a greater appreciation of investigative journalism, particularly.
Yes. Yeah.
But for the most part, given the slow death of the media, it's nice to see this movie that kind of celebrates what these people do and what they accomplish. And just, you know, I've always talked about this thing of like, it's fun to watch movies about people who are good at their job.
Right.
And where you learn what that job entails and how they do it and what the steps are.
Which is why there will never be a good movie about Donald Trump.
Oh, there will be a good movie, but it'll be about something else entirely.
You know what? I don't want to watch that movie. I've already had enough of the real life version.
I want to see the metaphorical version.
Sure.
That explores his utter vast emptiness inside.
Here's the one I want. I want the one that Harmony Korine directs.
Okay.
That's the one I want.
I want one that is about someone who is that utterly soulless and rises to the top and can't ever enjoy it for a second.
I don't want him to enjoy a moment of this.
Yeah, that's the movie I want
to
see.
I'm glad. If he's not enjoying anything right now, I'm happy.
This is a guy who is constantly having to, like, attempt to prove his legitimacy. Like, there was a great time.
Guess what?
We're veering again.
Guess what, new listeners?
we talk about this stuff, too.
We digress all the time. And these are our politics.
Yes.
Don't at me.
There was a New York Times piece today basically saying that really what the Comey thing was about was what he's really mad about the Russia thing is anybody that dares challenge the legitimacy of his candidacy and his election.
Right.
Like, this is a guy who gives visitors to the White House a map of the counties that he won in the Electoral College.
He is such garbage.
Yes. So anyway,
more about Obits, please.
More about Obits. So yeah, so it's a lovely movie celebrating things that should matter, both people's lives and the people who tell the story of those lives. It's beautifully shot. You know, I mean, it's mostly set inside the corridors of the Times,
right.
But they incorporate, you know, old home movie footage just to sort of imply the past, and they'll find old footage of certain people that they're talking about, whether they're like aviatrices or, you know, the guy who collaborated, like the story that you follow through the film is one of the main guys. I believe it's Bruce Weber, not that Bruce Weber,
a different Bruce Weber,
right. Not the photographer, who is writing an obit for JFK's TV consultant.
Okay,
you know, who was like one of the first people in politics to be a TV consultant, and who was the guy who was like, let's put some makeup on you before this debate with Richard Nixon.
Which, yeah.
You know, is a sort of turning point
in men's makeup
and in politics in general, you know, and in the mass media.
I just want to say, though, there was this moment where you had makeup on What the Flick, and you looked so weird.
Yeah, because I put it on myself and I didn't know what I was doing.
Do you still have it?
That makeup?
Yeah, where is that?
I don't know. Did you buy it? It's in a drawer somewhere.
It's in a drawer somewhere at the Young Turks. Network,
maybe,
right?
Yeah. It was given to me by someone who knows about makeup, but he didn't give me good enough instructions about how to apply it, so I gave up on it. And actually, they changed the lighting in the What the Flick studio, so now I don't constantly look like a bright red.
You look okay now.
Beefsteak tomato the way
yeah.
I used to.
Yeah.
So
you know, it's fine, because you know what they say: you can buy all the makeup that Mac can make.
That's right.
But if you don't look inside you.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
It doesn't matter.
Something, something damn unpretty.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, for a while there, the way they had the lighting set up, it looked
also,
like...
Also, you can buy your hair if it don't grow. That's another thing you can do.
My face looked like I had spent the entire day, like, you know, in the fields, and then ran in and, like, downed an entire fifth of bourbon. Like, that's how red my face was. So I saw Obits. You saw a documentary that I did not see.
That you will never see.
And will never see.
This documentary that I saw last night, it screened one time and one time only at the Downtown Independent Theater here in Los Angeles. That's the name of the theater, Downtown Independent. The name of the documentary.
Is The Smell still there?
The Smell is still around, yeah.
It's next door to The Smell, if you know The Smell.
At least I think The Smell is around. Listen, I haven't been to The Smell in 12 years. Mm-hmm. Like, so long. For, like, not.
It may or may not be there. Who knows?
Listen, I was never part of a scene. I just went. Borbotomagus,
mm-hmm.
colon, a pollock of sound.
Now, as in pollock, Jackson?
Not the fish.
Not Sydney.
As in, not Sydney, as in Jackson Pollock.
Okay.
Which is an appropriate title. Borbotomagus. Borbetomagus is a band. They have been around for nearly 40 years. If you don't know Borbetomagus, that's because you are not the kind of person who would ever want to listen to a band called Borbotomagus that does the kind of thing that Borbotomagus does? I, however, am that person. How to describe them?
How indeed?
They are a three-piece. One man plays tenor sax, one man plays alto sax, and one man plays guitar.
Is playing what they do to those instruments?
Yeah, they do. Okay. They play quite a lot with them. In fact, they do...
In the sense of, Mommy said I played too rough?
A little.
Okay.
If you go back in the day, go way, way back in the day, to people like Glenn Branca and early Sonic Youth, Borbotomagus was coming up around that same time, and the guitarist of the band was doing similar stuff. He was experimenting with freaky tunings. He was shoving things like pliers and, you know, forks and screwdrivers and all sorts of weird objects into the strings to get strange sounds. Concurrently, the sax players were doing things like inserting the microphones into the bell of the sax, and then playing bell to bell to produce a noise that, in the words of the film, in the words of a flyer, I just talked about this on Linoleum Nights.
Another subscriber-only program.
Another subscriber-only podcast. On one of their flyers, the description of their what they are is beyond music. And that is a thing, that is a kind of music that has always appealed to me. I've been a fan of noise music for forever now, more than half my life. And I have been a big fan of Borbotomagus for a long time. Now, last night's screening was the documentary and a live performance, first time that the band has played in Los Angeles in like 20 years. So we got a 1-2 punch last night, and I didn't get home until 1 a.m.
Ooh!
Which is 5 hours after my normal weeknight bedtime. I went with Aaron, but I want to talk about the documentary.
Right, and I just have a quick question off the top of my head, which is, I've seen a lot of documentaries about bands that I would not necessarily be into or would not have pursued.
Yes.
But by the end of the movie, I'm like, huh, I would kind of maybe want to check this out. Is there anything in this movie for people who are not fans of the crazy harsh noise music in quotation marks that you like so much?
Here's what I'm going to get to that answer.
Okay.
The film itself as a documentary, it's a short documentary. It's about 65, 70 minutes long. And it's set up, formally, it's more like
Only the Grateful Dead gets 4 hours.
Formally, it's more like an essay. There's a lot of static still photography, a lot of interviews with other people like Rudolph Gray and Thurston Moore and other, the guys from Hijo Kaidan, a Japanese noise band that I like a lot.
Talking heads or just voiceover?
No, it's voiceover over this still photography. So it's a very static sort of film in that there's not, other than the archival footage of the band performing, and there's a lot of that, there's not a lot going on. So it reminded me in a way almost of a critical essay, a review even of the band, one that was clearly, you know, meant to proselytize. Now, because I'm already a fan, its formal shortcomings did not bother me so much. I wish I had seen more about their everyday lives, because they, as human beings, the band members come off as mysteriously as they do in a performance. You don't know them. They perform for you and they go away.
So it's not like the Hillsong documentary.
No, exactly. It's not like the Hillsong documentary at all. You learn everything about Hillsong and all those folks. What you know about them is that they were sort of outsiders in the early 80s during, the no wave and no New York and no and noise scene of New York City.
They're Americans.
They are American. They were sort of outsiders to that scene, with a few exceptions. Thurston Moore, obviously a fan of them. And he has performed with them, I believe, as well. You know that about them. And you know now about them that they are in their mid-60s, nearly 70. These guys are getting older. And yet, I witnessed them last night creating a level of sonic brutality that required heavy-duty, high-grade earplugs for me to deal with it. That's not the kind of thing you expect from someone who is past what we consider to be retirement age. So I wish there had been an exploration of
Being old in rock or in experimental music.
being old and part of experimental music, and what's that like? And what are your day jobs? Because it's not like anyone's getting rich off experimental, improvisational noise jazz.
Right.
So those are the blanks that I wish the film had filled in. If the film had filled in those blanks, I would say this was a movie for everybody. Everybody who's interested in things that are not part of their own experience. Like, I know you don't ever want to listen to this music, but I think that if the film had been more whole,
Right.
you would have watched it and maybe come away with, at least an understanding of who these guys are, why they do what they do, and not just, they interview Byron Coley, who's a cool music writer, and he does a really good job of explaining the physicality of the music they produce. And I really appreciated that. And I think Byron Coley is very cool. But I would like it if, you could see this movie and get something out of it.
So then the fact that
It's for fans,
I would say the
is
fact
what I'm ultimately
that they
saying.
set this up as a one-time screening with a performance afterwards, I think kind of speaks volumes about who this movie's audience is, which is
Me.
the converted.
Yeah, me.
Okay. Well, that's too bad because I mean, I like seeing movies that take me into a place that I don't know anything about.
And that you would never go live.
Right,
Yeah.
exactly,
You just live with someone who does live there.
Yes.
And that's all the contact you really need.
Right.
Because even that amount of contact is too much for you.
I hope that it is indeed. I hope that Major Lazer documentary that was at Sundance this year that I
Oh, I
reviewed
bet it'll show up somewhere.
gets out in the world because I really didn't know anything about them and I really enjoyed that. So, but we'll talk about that when it finally shows up. Snatched.
Is boring.
It's quite a letdown, I have to say,
It's a big letdown.
because the movie that you envision in your head when you hear that Goldie Hawn is coming out of retirement and making a mother-daughter comedy with Amy Schumer.
You are excited by that news.
Yeah, like
I was.
that movie in your head is so much better
Yeah.
than what you get.
Yeah. I was expecting, honestly, so much more just wild physical comedy from both of them.
Yeah.
And I was expecting more. I was expecting more of like when I say physical comedy, I mean like body,
Yeah.
not BAWDY, but like,
BODY.
yeah, expecting that kind of comedy. And I was expecting smart person comedy, which is what we get from Amy Schumer. She
Yes.
takes conventions that are applied to women and used to constrict women, and pukes on them and turns them inside out. And I love that
Yes.
about her. This film is not that at all.
And the setup of this
Not
movie,
enough
the
at
setup,
all.
the setup of the movie expects you, or it sets you up to expect a certain narrative and emotional arc because you have a mother-daughter and they don't really get along, and the mother has been kind of cloistering herself since getting divorced I thought this would have been a great time to re-unpack Ready to Take a Chance Again from Foul Play.
Why didn't they use that song?
I know.
As a goof for old people who know what that means.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Amy Schumer has just been dumped by her boyfriend. She's got these two tickets to go to Ecuador. And so she drags her mom, even though that's the last person she wants to take, but it's the last person left because nobody else wants to go with her. And, of course, then they get kidnapped and, you know, nuttiness ensues.
Can we talk about why no one wants to go with Amy Schumer?
Sure.
She's toxic. Her character is toxic. And yet you're meant to sort of also be on her side.
Yeah, I mean... She's
useless.
The movie wants to present her as thoroughly narcissistic and you know, awful. And at the same time, we're supposed to side with her when she gets annoyed at Goldie Hawn for getting annoyed with
her. It's a fun character that Amy Schumer is good at playing when Amy Schumer is in full control of the narrative outcome of that person. But it doesn't feel like she's in control of it here.
There's a scene where that's supposed to represent the shift of her character into becoming somebody who cares about other people.
No.
That's so ineptly portrayed that I thought they're making fun of this kind of scene, right? Like, this is a joke, right?
I immediately thought about Carrie Underwood bandaging the head of a tsunami survivor in the movie Soul Surfer.
Yeah.
Literally, that was the thought that popped into my head. I thought, this is the Carrie Underwood wrapping a person's head in a bandage moment.
I mean,
why is this happening?
There are some funny moments that I laughed some, but like Goldie Hawn never gets the moment where her character busts out and like takes charge or shifts in any way. So much of what we're supposed to assume has happened to both these characters, they sort of decide to take as read and don't bother to really illustrate or dramatize in any way.
It's lazy.
Weirdly enough, some of the biggest laughs come from scenes that neither of them are in. There's a running gag between Ike Barinholtz, who plays Amy Schumer's brother, and Bashir Salahuddin, who you may remember as
Malik
from HBO's Looking.
I remember him as Malik.
You were looking at him.
I was, yes.
Everyone was looking at Malik. Anyway, so the two of them have several scenes together that are funny. There's some Wanda Sykes and Joan Cusack stuff that's
Wanda Sykes
pretty
and Joan
funny.
Cusack, when they are on screen, everything brightens up.
Yes. Yeah. They bring a weirdness to things.
And
that
Joan Cusack doesn't speak for the entire film.
Yeah, there's that scale of like, I didn't laugh at all, or I laughed just enough. Yeah. I laughed, but not enough. And it just feels...
And the laughs were this.
Yeah, it just really feels like a wasted opportunity.
I feel bad for this movie. Part of me wants it to still make money so that...
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Female mother-daughter films can be made. Go on.
I want to say, it comes from people who generally know what they're doing. It's written by Katie Dippold, who wrote The Heat. She wrote the Ghostbusters remake.
Something went terribly wrong, and we don't know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Feig didn't direct this one, although he did produce. This is directed by Jonathan Levine, who I like. I liked 50...
Who knows better.
Yeah, he did 50-50, he did Warm Bodies.
That's the thing. Everyone here knows better.
Yeah. And again, I sometimes feel like it's that thing that I complain about all the time with like Bibbs and Robert and stuff, is that comedies need to be written.
Yeah.
Like, we've gotten so in love with these, like, we'll cast funny people and they'll just make up wacky shit on the set. On the set, and, you know, and it'll be funny in the moment. And like, yeah, you can get some funny stuff there. But overall, like, movies, especially movies that are farcical or whatever, like, they need structure. You know, you look at great old comedies, like, you know, I don't know, Some Like It Hot, or, you know, even What's Up Doc, which is, well, I guess it's old now, it's 45 years old.
Yeah, it is.
But like, you know, those are written, structured, beautifully crafted comedies, and so much stuff now is so sloppy and thrown together, and it, you know, so much of that sort of Apatow, Will Ferrell school of things, it's a mess, and it doesn't work.
And I want to go after this film also for its treatment of Ecuador.
I was going to bring that up. Yes.
Do you know what's been happening in actual Ecuador recently?
No.
Like, a progressive revolution.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, I don't have all the details, but I've just been reading about this in a skimming sort of way. And yet, here's what we see of Ecuador.
Resorts.
A resort where they tell you that anything outside of the resort is death-defyingly dangerous. And then you see some peaceful mountain people living cooperatively and passing buckets of water to one another that Amy Schumer gets to jump in and help everybody with. And I think to myself as I'm watching this, A, y'all filmed this in Hawaii. B, did anyone pay attention or look up on Wikipedia at least the actual country of Ecuador and how things are there? The idea of, you want to see a movie about where about people being kidnapped in South America?
Oh, right. Mandabala.
Mandabala. It's a documentary about people in Brazil being kidnapped all the time. There's a lazy, thoughtless, I'm going to stop short of calling it racism, although I think it is racism.
Benign is not the word here, but it's reflexive. It's not active.
It's the kind of racism that white people just do when they don't think about anything.
Exactly.
And once again, it's one of those films where if you get all the people together who made it, they'd say, no, we're not racist. But everyone gets kidnapped in Ecuador, so white people have to be scared.
And the movie touches on what and could have been.
You're stuck.
Yeah, there's a funny idea there about American tourists who go to wherever they want in the world, and then the second this thing goes wrong, they think that SEAL Team 6 is going to come in and rescue them.
That's funny.
That's a funny idea that the movie does not pursue with much interest at all.
Well, it pursues it, but it doesn't do it well or with wit at all.
So yeah, it's a letdown. All these folks deserve better. What's your DVD pick this week?
Illicit.
Tell me more.
1931, pre-code. Well, kind of pre-code.
That wobbly middle period. That
weird middle period where everyone was saying, "Well, here's the code. Maybe do it.
It's optional."
Yeah. So Barbara Stanwyck, 22-year-old Barbara Stanwyck.
Oh, wow.
Is a modern woman. She lives with her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And they are high society people.
Is the phrase free love ever used?
No.
Okay.
But they do say things like, "I belong to no one. I belong to myself. And I don't want the shackles of marriage to weigh me down and to cause our love to dissipate under society's expectations." And her man's like, "Okay, yeah, sure." She just gets her way. But then the rich father comes along and says, "No, you must get married." And so they get
married. His or hers?
His. So they get married, and sure enough, jealousy and resentment and, you know, dependency and all the things that are annoyances to modern people.
Right.
They even hint at non-monogamy from time to time.
You?
Oh, yeah. These are progressive-looking, thinking people. You know, they're not going to be bound by rules.
All right.
And then, you know, of course, they learn the error of their ways.
It's a Hollywood movie.
It is... First of all, it's a delight. It's also about 75, 80 minutes long.
Nice.
And
early talking.
Barbara Stanwyck is so just headstrong and nervy that you're cheering for her through the whole film. You're like, "No, get everything you want, the way you want it." And then, you know, of course, because it's 1931 and the Hays Code is happening and they're not going to let anybody get out of this without, you know, behaving. They all behave at the end, but that doesn't make it not worth seeing.
But along the way,
it's so cool.
Gotcha.
And she's fantastic. And there's, you know, fun society drunks.
Oh, good.
In there.
And Joan Blondell.
And Joan Blondell. Yeah.
Yeah. If all you know about Joan Blondell is Kathy Bates on Feud, dig in. Joan Blondell in the 30s was a hot tomato and funny and sexy and all the things.
She was a hot tomato.
Yeah. Go watch like Gold Diggers of 1933 or something.
I really love that expression.
Yeah.
Hot tomato. There's this great moment where there's a wedding shower happening, and the ladies are bringing Barbara Stanwyck lingerie. Yeah. And one of the women says, "Which one will be the first night outfit?" And another woman says, "Oh, no, it's not that kind of wedding."
Oh, yeah.
Ha-cha-cha. They're already doing it. Everybody knows they're already doing it.
Do people bring up, like, oh, think of the children?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, they don't say anything about children.
Okay.
They're like, we're not making those loathsome little filthy creatures. We're society people.
There you go.
Yeah.
My DVD pick this week is a movie I thought about a lot during Snatched that I wanted it to be more like, and that is Romancing the Stone. Mm. Written by the late, great Diane Thomas, who sadly, I don't even know if she was alive by the time the movie came out, but she died soon thereafter, unfortunately, and which is a real pity because it's such a great screenplay. It delivers all the things you want in terms of a fun action movie and a character-driven comedy.
Yep.
And, you know, we were talking about the whole sort of racial issues of Snatched. In this movie, like, your main villains are white guys. There is sort of, like, one terrifying drug dealer type. But then you've also got that great Alfonso Arau character who seems to be like he's going to be bad news, but then it turns out he is a huge fan of the crappy romance novels that the Kathleen Turner character writes, and yes. So he becomes, like, her guardian angel.
And it's got that Billy Ocean song that's so good.
No. That's Jewel of the Nile.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I get it mixed up.
Eddie Grant actually sang the theme song to Romancing the Stone.
Okay, no, I don't care about Eddie Grant.
All right.
I care about Billy Ocean.
Billy Ocean sang the song from Jewel of the Nile, which was the sequel, which is not nearly
when
as good.
When the going gets rough.
Yes.
One of many great Billy Ocean songs.
So many. Who can count?
Caribbean Queen. Lover Boy.
Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car.
Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car. Lover Boy. It is one of the best songs of the 1980s. Loverboy.
If you say so.
I'm telling you the truth.
Anyway, Romancing the Stone, great movie. A lot of wonderful little character bits along the way. I love, oh God, why? Holland Trainor in that movie. Holland Taylor, sorry. Kathleen Turner's editor, there's a scene, and they totally ripped this off on a recent episode of Powerless, which sadly got canceled. I think that was a show that had some promise. But there's a scene where one of the people in the office takes, why am I blanking on this actress's name? Vanessa Hudgens, yes, out to this bar, and Vanessa Hudgens is sort of like going down the row of men and explaining why they're not worth it, you know?
Yeah.
And it just reminds me of the scene in Romancing the Stone where Holland Taylor's like, wimp. Loser, loser, major loser. Too happy, too angry. So yeah, Romancing the Stone still holds up, you know, after decades. Back before Robert Zemeckis got totally lost in CG land and knew how right. to make funny comedies with human beings in them. So,
I need you to do me a favor.
Uh-huh.
I need you to pause this recording because I have to tend to my rice.
Okay.
For this recipe, and you can pull up letters.
I will do that.
And then we'll be right back in a moment.
Well, for us a moment, for you guys,
immediately.
Seconds away.
Yeah.
Okay, this first letter is from Ryan.
Oh, wait, are we on again?
Yeah.
Oh, we're back. Wait, when did you start recording us again?
When I said, okay, this first letter is from all Ryan.
Right. So everything I was talking about
no, all the not, was not recording
things
then.
To,
I would tell you
all
if
the
I
things
were
on my to-do
then.
List.
Yes, they were super fascinating to the rest of the world, but it's I've deprived them of it.
It's very important.
Okay. Ryan writes, "Hello, Dave and Alonzo. I hope this message finds you well.
Hello, Ryan.
I'm very happy to be writing to you again, and thank you so much for reading my last letter and giving so many great book suggestions.
Oh.
My question for you today is about your work as movie critics.
Yes.
I am by no means one, but I do write reviews for a small blog, and I wanted to get your thoughts on reviewing older films, or even just thinking about them as a viewer.
Do it.
I was watching the 1933 original King Kong film, and I couldn't get emotionally or intellectually invested in what was going on, as the stakes were robbed of their value by the quality of effects available at the time.
Well, yeah.
Yet when I look at how many people rate and review the film, I see people giving this high grades and calling it a masterpiece.
Yes.
Relative to films in 1933, and in terms of historic value, I can't necessarily argue. But if I compared this to, say, Kong Skull Island, I was much more drawn into the latter film and what was going on, even if that film will inevitably be forgotten and the 1933 film won't. How do you go about analyzing, thinking about, and potentially assigning ratings to films like these? Do you give them breaks? Do you give them very low grades? Or, and this last option is very possible, am I just totally crazy for not getting invested in these classics? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thank you, as always.
Having a sense of history is required here. And you can only have that sense of history by watching those old films and getting used to them.
Yeah.
Getting used to their look, getting used to the rhythms, getting used to how they were directed, getting used to the styles of acting that were popular throughout the decades.
It's like studying Shakespeare and having to sort of attune yourself to the language.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You just have to dive in and look at a whole bunch of it and become familiar with that moment in history. Film is not the same thing that it was 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago, 80 years ago. It just isn't. Everything moves, everything progresses, everything changes. And so if you, you know, can't get with a film from 1933 because it's odd to you, and it is odd.
Sure.
Compared to today, the way, you know,
people spoke and they dress and they...
And, well, it's not just how they speak and dress, although speaking is a big deal.
Yeah.
But, you know, what technology was available to make movies back then? You have to just sort of understand the moment that it was made.
And I think also if you can forgive certain things for, you know, it being the best they could do at the time, you can still find an emotional truth that still matters. I mean, like, one of my favorite movies is F.W. Murnau's Sunrise, which technically was actually quite sophisticated for 1927 and really sort of indicated how advanced cinematography and editing and other things had gotten right before sound happened, and that sort of slammed the door on a lot of things because, you know, the camera became the slave to the microphone and things got locked down and people didn't, you know, the camera didn't move and the people didn't move.
Right.
And, you know, it gets kind of stilted. But, you know, whatever happens with Sunrise, even as a silent film, even as a black and white film, even as a film that is very much of its era in terms of the way people lived and what they looked like and that kind of thing, it still resonates in the honesty of its portrayal of a marriage that is falling apart and that manages to find its way back together again.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's still stuff to be gleaned from these films. It's sort of like, you know, Hamlet and Macbeth still have meaning. You just have to kind of wrestle your way through all the these and thous.
Correct.
This one's from Logan. He writes, one of my favorite moments watching What the Flick was witnessing Dave's epic and well-warranted rant against Roland Emmerich.
Oh, well, yes.
During the review of Independence Day, who wanted this?
I was a hero that day.
Oh, yes. No question. I recently got married to the love of my life. Who knows that when I was younger, I had some gay experiences with a few of my male friends. My wife herself identifies as bisexual.
Right on.
I just want to thank you both for what you do and to express how much I look forward to not only your movie reviews, but also the love, insight, and wisdom that makes up the heart of your podcast.
Love.
You guys are truly inspiring, and I hope to be able to listen to you both for years to come. Well, we hope that too.
Sexy, sexy love.
Thank you, Logan, and congrats on your wedding. This one's called Fan Question About Michelle Rodriguez. It's from a different Ryan.
Okay.
He says, hello, Linoleum Knife. I just want to start by saying I've been a big fan since What the Flick started. I'm such a fan that I know you've both seen and maybe admired the car crash that is Red Lights.
Remind me
we
which
didn't
one
admire
that is.
The Robert De Niro is a blind psychic surgeon and Sigourney Weaver is out to debunk him. Crazy, crazy
movie. Yeah. Oh, Oh, God, I had forgotten that that existed.
Yeah, that is, it is, I mean, we loved watching it, but it's Looney Balls.
That's a Millennium film, right?
Yes, it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I believe I've just seen the 2017 version of it called The Assignment.
Yes.
The only common thread there being Sigourney Weaver playing someone smarter than the room, yet people ask inane questions like, or yet she asks inane, people inane questions like, do you read Poe?
Oh, God.
When it's not necessary.
I'll tell you, Red Lights. Red Lights?
Red Lights.
That was so much more goofishly entertaining
than The Assignment.
The Assignment just made me cringe from start to finish.
Yeah. It also stars Michelle Rodriguez as a trans assassin pre and post-op with matching nude scenes. My question is, what is the appeal of Michelle Rodriguez as a thespian? Thespian?
Have you seen...
I understand people like her because she is pretty, but she has never enraptured me with her performances. I've been on the other end of arguments...
There's a lot of appeal to her as that other kind of espion.
I've been on the other end of arguments where people vehemently defend her, and I'm still not impressed. Thanks ahead for ahead
Did
of time
you see
for
Girl Fight?
Reading my email and keep up the great work.
Have you seen Girl Fight? That is my question for you.
Yes.
Her debut in Girl Fight...
was quite striking.
Very.
I would argue
and
that
then she started getting big movies and getting big paydays and has decided she just doesn't care.
I would argue that she brings the right tone to the Fast and Furious movies.
Absolutely.
That she totally knows what movie she's in.
Yep. She's got the tough girl routine down cold. And
her fight scene with Gina Carano in Fast...
And if that is
five, six,
if that is everything we get from her for the rest of her career, I think that will be enough.
Mm.
I wish there could be a little more. I would like for her to return to something like Girl Fight, where she was required to do a lot more emotional work than she's been required to do in literally
pretty much
everything
else. Yeah. No, it would be nice to see somebody really kind of push her to do something that way.
You know what I would like? I want Claire Denis to get her hands on Michelle Rodriguez.
Well, there you go.
That's what I want. I mean, I say this all the time. I want Claire Denis to get her hands on everybody. But
well, who directed Girl Fight? It was Karen Kusama, right?
Karen Kusama.
I would love to see the two of them work again together.
That would be good.
Because, you know,
that would be really good.
Kusama had a great... film last year with The Invitation, so you know, I'm always excited to see what she's got. He also says, P.S. small question, how do you guys promote your podcast? I've recently started I've recently started mine, Weekend Flex, and I could use some tips from the pros.
Weekend Flex?
Yes.
F-L-E-X. What is it about?
It doesn't say.
Is it about my muscles? It should be.
That you only work on the weekend? Is that what that's about?
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you,
my
we
stirring foods.
We you know, we Twitter and we Facebook.
We
and
Twitter
we
and we Instagram.
Instagram
and we Facebook, and we try not to annoy people too much. And according to people who are pros at this sort of thing, we are doing a half-assed job at promoting ourselves, even though I think, personally, that we promote ourselves all the time.
Yeah.
And I worry about being...
too annoying.
Too annoying about it, yeah. So I don't know what to tell you. Answering that, just let it happen, let it grow. It'll grow really slowly into what you will hope maybe will be a small good thing or a big good thing.
Let word of mouth grow. You know,
we've spent 6 years doing this, and I think we're a small good thing.
Almost seven.
Almost
six,
seven.
Six and a half. Yeah,
almost seven. I think of us as you know, little potatoes, but our audience, people who listen, y'all listening, you're really nice to us. Some of you are Patreon subscribers / club members. You know, people write us all the time and tell us they like it, and that's very nice.
And, you know, a lot of times on Twitter, like, somebody will sort of say, hey, what podcast should I be listening to?
And other people will say, listen to Linoleum Knife.
Which we always appreciate.
We don't have to do that work. it's
less unseemly when it's not us saying it, so, you know.
Yeah,
there's no magic formula for those of us who are doing this with no money and no celebrity quotient. So you just got to do the thing and hope the right people find it and let the...
We grew from tiny, 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 you know, 3 dozen listeners to, what did you just tell me the other day? We're about to have our...
By the end of the year, we will have our millionth download.
That's crazy
to me.
I know.
It's bananas.
And, you know, And that makes us sound bigger than we are, because, again, it took 7 years to accumulate that many downloads. But it still blows my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have an answer for you.
Yeah.
I just make your podcast and hope people like it, and they'll tell other people about it.
Yeah. I mean, and obviously, and you probably already know this, but if there's no money in it or whatever, do a thing that means something to you. Don't feel like you're trying to, like, you're giving the market what it wants or whatever. Like, yeah, just do it. Make it all
do
you.
Do the thing you want to do, and do it exactly the way you want to do it. Exactly. How many times have you and I been told over the years that we're doing it wrong?
Yeah, no, believe me,
that we
quite regularly
that we're not structured enough,
mm-hmm.
that we're too self-indulgent, and that we just start talking about
chit-chat and clap-trap,
whatever we feel like talking about. We go off topic.
Yeah,
our sound quality is bad or something. You know, and honestly, occasionally it is.
Yes. No argument here.
We record this at our dining room table. This is not, I mean, the windows are open, there's street noise, and the helicopters going past, and dogs barking, and interruptions, neighbors coming over and just opening the door, and the phone going off, and
the UPS guy shows up, you know.
How many times have people told us that they hate, that we just kind of go on and on and on,
mm-hmm. you know? Or they hate your voice.
One woman hates my voice and quit listening.
So yeah, just do.
She's like, I could not stand the guy with the growly voice.
make the show you want to hear, and hopefully the people who also want to hear that show will find it and figure it out.
Yeah,
that's kind of all we know how to do.
We just decided to turn the microphone on one day. These are conversations, minus the exposition about film narrative, film plots, which we wouldn't have to tell each other, obviously, because we've seen the movie, unless it's a film that he saw that I didn't, or whatever. Minus that, these are the conversations we were having for years before we ever turned on the microphone.
Yeah, they were just happening in the car on the way home from the movie theater or whatever.
Or 3 days after the movie.
Yeah.
That's it. We never decided we were going to be professional anythings. We just were thinking.
And it shows.
We are film critics. We make our living doing that. And we have conversations. So maybe someone wants to listen to that.
And those of you who do, thank you.
Yeah.
This is a short one from Wilson. The title is The Pillaring of La La Land, Ray Race.
Okay.
And he writes, Alonzo is right and Dave is wrong. There. He wrote the there, by the way, not me.
Okay.
Thank you, Wilson.
Yeah, you're right. There.
Here's a pro-Dave letter, just because I believe in balance, you never do.
I don't need pro-Dave letters.
But here it is anyway.
I mean, I love them,
mm.
and I make certain that you know that they're pro-Dave when I read them. But I don't feel bereft of praise if we have 3 or 4 letters in a row that are all about how great you are. I know how great you are. I married your ass.
Indeed. This one's from Rob. He says, Hi, Dave and Alonzo. Just wanted to say a massive thanks to Dave for his review of That's My Boy. I recently started tutoring a first-year university course in communication and was struggling to find contemporary examples of high versus low culture. Using your review in class...
Whoa, dude. I feel sorry for your students.
...helped to generate a discussion on how popular culture has been viewed historically, along with the distinctions between good and bad media that continue to exist.
Yeah.
So thanks, Dave. I always enjoy listening to the podcast, and having an opportunity to share the word of LK makes the job worth it. I also finished Exile in Guyville recently. What's the latest with the follow-up?
You just keep on waiting. You just keep on waiting. Anticipating. Good things are going to come to you sometime when I'm done.
And
with all that writing.
He's also said, because as a thanks to Dave, I wanted to submit a list for knifing. I anticipate a 50%. This is an epic trolling of me list. Are you ready for this?
Epic trolling of you, Alonzo Duralde?
Yes.
Okay, here we go.
American Ultra.
Yes.
No. Pulp Fiction.
Yes.
No. The Shawshank Redemption.
It's not a good movie, but I really liked it, yes.
No.
Okay. But I'm telling you, it's not a good movie.
Speed Racer.
Oh, God, the best.
No. Freddy Got Fingered.
A misunderstood high art comedy.
No. Julian Donkey Boy.
So moving and so beautiful and tragic.
No. I don't know that I saw this one. The Future?
Oh, God. The Future broke my heart.
I will give you The Future because I never saw it. I saw The East.
You saw The Future. The Future. Miranda July is the talking cat.
Oh, no. Okay, I was thinking, what's the movie I'm thinking?
Miranda July makes the world a better place.
What is the movie I'm thinking of that's the other lady that you like?
I like a lot of ladies.
Yeah, I know. What's the Britt Marling movie? It's Sound of My Voice. And
Sound of My Voice.
I thought there was one.
I like The East.
I think I'm thinking The East of the Future. Ending. Yeah, The East of the Rotten. The Future. Ugh, that movie. Everything is Illuminated.
That was just okay.
Okay, you weren't a fan either?
It was fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
No. Inherent Vice.
A masterpiece.
No. And Black Hat.
Tentative, yes. So, you get actually, you're like 85% knife on this list.
No.
Or 90% knife on this
list. No, you're like 55% knife. Oh, no, sorry, no, 50, because I did see The Future. Yeah, that's a 50, because you said yes on everything.
Straight up 50.
Yeah, I see what you're doing here, Rob.
Black Hat and Everything is Illuminated. I don't think Everything is Illuminated is so great. Black Hat might be better than I thought it was. I keep seeing
defenses of that one. I'm like, yeah, I'm not. Mm-mm.
Well, the reason you keep seeing defenses of it is because dudes can't let things go.
Oh, yeah, I know. Michael Mann. Yeah. However, he does say, P.S. Alonzo, your What the Flick review of XXX3 is now tied with your reaction to Matt comparing Warcraft to Princess Mononoke. Hilarious. So thank you for that. One last one, because this one cracks me up, and we've been sitting on it for a while. This is from my friend James, my college friend James.
Yes.
Dear Alonzo and Dave, my wife and I sat down to watch our Netflix DVD of Edge of 17 last night.
Which one?
The Edge of 17.
The Haley Steinfeld one.
Yes.
Okay.
Excellent film. The trailers start playing automatically, and we usually watch them.
Yeah.
First up, The Space Between Us.
Smoke.
I pointed out the character that Dave calls Candy Bones.
It's because his bones are made of candy that will melt and
if he comes to the earth, the candy will shatter.
Yes.
The Pez cannot stand our gravity.
It cannot.
Next, a bad horror film. An off-screen voice intones, "He's real. If you say his name or even think of it, he'll come for you." I whispered, "Candy Bones."
But you know it.
Yeah, we're getting there. This continued with increasing urgency. "Don't make me say it. Don't say it. Don't think it. Candy Bones." "What the hell is that? What is it?" "Candy Bones." "He's found us. Who? Candy Bones." When the title was revealed to be The Bye Bye Man.
Come on, say the real title.
A.K.A. The Pee Pee Poo Poo Man. We agreed that Candy Bones was no worse of a title for a horror film. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need
you won't be laughing when he kills you.
I need to get started on my spec script.
Who said that? Who made that joke? Because this is an internet meme.
Yeah.
God, the best.
The fake posters of the pee-pee poo-poo man.
You won't be laughing when he kills you.
James writes, "Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to get working on my spec script. Working title, Linoleum Knife Presents the Extra Large Medium Meets Candy Bones." James in Charlottesville. James,
you're full of inside jokes.
All right, that's us for this week. Again, I'm going to be on Pop Rocket, so check that out. Also, check out all of our friends on the internet. If you've not listened to my episode of Canceled Too Soon, in which Bibbs and Whitney and I dig deep into all 30 episodes of the one-season wonder My Mother, the Car, a series you've made jokes about but probably never watched, go listen to that one. Also, check out their show, the B-Movies Podcast. listen to Dennis Edwin with Dennis Hensley and the Schmoes Know and the Comics Canon and the Joel Ryan thing and the Sewers of Paris, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can follow this program on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Linoleum Cast. Subscribe to us for free on iTunes and leave us a positive review because that helps a lot. You can also leave us positive feedback at all the places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, thelounge.com, Podbean, CastBox, iVoox, and various other joints. Thank you, Blue, for our great theme music. We appreciate it. Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. And we have t-shirts for sale if you would like them. Black shirts with linoleum knife and white letters in all the sizes. $22. PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. If you're outside of the U.S.,
it's more.
Email us first.
Talk to me.
Tell us where you are, and we'll tell you how much extra postage it is.
When I get my laptop back, I can start fulfilling some orders that are outstanding.
It'll be very exciting. And yeah, so anyway, have a good week. We'll catch you guys next time.
Goodbye.